For the sake of those of you who don't know me and for the sake of the tape, my name is Jeannie Olson, and the name of this class is Grief from Wilderness to Healing. Before I begin this class, I sort of need to know who I'm working with here and what the type of situation we have here. So I'm going to ask you to raise your hand if in the last 2 years you've experienced a grief or a loss, whether it be a death of a loved one, the loss of health, a divorce, the loss of a job, anything where you have experienced and gone through a grief process. Would you just raise your hand if you've been through something like that in the last 2 years? Okay. Because we do have a few people that have been through a loss, then I'm going to say one other thing. This topic isn't exactly an uplifting, exciting, fun topic. In fact, I said to my husband last night, who teaches the literature class that follows this, how envious I was of him because he got to work with literature and got to make people laugh and feel good and feel inspired and all these neat things. And I talk about grief, you know. So I just, I want to say ahead of time that my purpose in this class is not therapeutic. It's not to bring up feelings from some of you who have been through grief of sadness or anger or guilt or what other feelings you might have having gone through your grief process. But I'm saying this to tell you that that might happen. That's not my purpose, but when we're talking about various aspects of grief, sometimes those things do creep up. Feelings and emotions that you thought you had taken care of, and it may find themselves coming up. And what I want to say to you is that's perfectly normal for that to happen, and that's perfectly okay. And if you find your neighbor is weeping, just pat him on the leg or put your arm around him or hand him a Kleenex. But please don't leave is the other thing I want to say, is because we are going to be talking about some pretty heavy stuff. And if you find those feelings coming up, if you leave, we're not going to be able to work on those things and talk about them and head for the light at the end of the tunnel. So don't leave. Please stay with us, and hopefully we can work on some of those feelings. But again, I'd say this isn't a therapy-type session. I'm going to start by telling you a story that happened about 3 months ago. Now, I want to ask, first of all, can everyone hear? I know when I turn to this side, it gets louder because this thing sits here. Does it get too loud when I turn this way? Okay. If you can't hear me or if you find I'm screeching, please tell me. I was working in the hallway of our house about 3 months ago, probably cleaning up dog hair and cobwebs, which are numerous. And while I was doing this, I overheard a conversation going on in the next room between my father-in-law, who was visiting us, and my husband. And my father-in-law said to my husband, "Well, it's been 34 years since your brother was killed." And my husband said, "Oh yes, tomorrow is October 3rd, isn't it?" And to give you background of that situation, my brother-in-law, as he would have been, was 14 when he was killed in a hunting accident. My husband was 10, his brother was 14. He was shot in the face by his friend while they were out duck hunting. My father-in-law doesn't talk often of this incident, and so in our 15 years of marriage, I had never heard the next statement that was to come out of his mouth. And he said to my husband, "You know, some people say that that wasn't an accident." And I actually gasped. And then he went on to say, "You know, somebody said to me if I wanted to know the truth of that situation, I should go over to Elk River and talk to the gentleman that runs the bait and tackle shop. But I never went." And then the conversation continued. My husband and father-in-law conversed on this topic. And near the end of the conversation, my father-in-law said, "I never went. What would it change? And what good would it have done?" Well, my profession is I'm a grief counselor. And I haven't talked to my father-in-law yet, but I think it would have made a big difference in his healing process. Because what he did is he put up a barrier to his ability to heal. The barrier he put up is that he didn't allow himself to have all the questions answered about the situation, about the death of his oldest son. And if he's still talking about that 34 years later and brings the topic up, I think it was and still is an important issue for him. One of the other things about my father-in-law, and I want to tell you I love him dearly, but my father-in-law is, and still is, he was the rock and still is of the community. He was the rock of his church. He was a superintendent of schools. He was a principal. He was always looked up to. My father-in-law is also Scandinavian, full-blooded, as am I, so I know what I'm talking about. In fact, I almost named this class Grief and Loss, the Problem with Being Scandinavian. But I figured some of you Scandinavians wouldn't come. I also would include Germans in this, but we Scandinavians have a tendency not to work on our grief. What do? We shed our tears at the appropriate time, and then we pull ourselves up by bootstraps, and we go on, and we forge ahead, and we're stoic, because that's the way we're brought up. That's the way we Scandinavians and Germans handle grief. And we think that's probably a pretty good thing. The unfortunate thing is, if we don't let our grief out, it's going to work itself out, sometimes in an unhealthy way. So when I found that out about my Scandinavian-ness, then I wasn't quite as proud about being Norwegian as I had been before, because I realized it was an inhibiting factor. I repeat that I think he made the mistake. He should have gone and had the questions answered. People say time heals. In fact, in our newspaper about 3 months ago, an article came out, and this woman had researched for 7 years and said, time is a great healer. Now, that it took her 7 years to come up with this is quite amazing to me, but she did all this research, and that was her general conclusion for her thesis, was that time was the great healer when it came to grief. 3 weeks after that, same newspaper, another article comes out, for some the grief never ends. Contrary to popular myth, time does not heal all wounds. So we have two authorities saying the exact opposite thing. I would venture to say in my work that both of them are right and both of them are wrong. Time does heal. It makes it more bearable. But it depends on what you do with the time. A woman came to us who had lost her husband. She was in her 30s and had one child. She locked herself in her house for a year. The only time she went out was to buy groceries and to go to her daughter's class discussion with the teacher, conference with the teacher. She came to us after a year and said, I thought time healed. I feel worse now after a year than I did after 2 weeks. I'm in worse shape. What time does, what you do with the time is what's important, I should say. It's what you do in that time frame that depends on whether you'll work through that grief or whether you'll sabotage your healing process by things you do to yourself, which is what my father-in-law did, or what other people do to you. My next story. A woman came to me who leads the Compassionate Friends Group. Now, the Compassionate Friends Group, for those of you who don't know, is a support group for people who have lost children. Children have died. And this local woman was going to be gone for a while, so she wanted me to take the literature for Compassionate Friends because she knew that we worked with people and had a small group for people whose children had died. She said, I want to bring you the information, because I just said she could send it to me. Well, I sensed that there was more in her mission than bringing me the material, so I asked her into my office and said, how did you happen to get into Compassionate Friends? Which was her opener to tell me her story. And she said, 8 years ago, two of my children, an older child and a younger child. The older child was going to take the younger child on a motorcycle just around the block. So they didn't wear helmets. And a truck backed over and killed both children. Now that was 8 years ago. And she said to me, My husband had to go and identify the children, but they wouldn't let me see the children. And then she shook her head and she said, Jeannie, you're going to think I'm crazy. And I said, I don't think I'll think you're crazy. Believe me. So she said, okay, I'll tell you. She said, sometimes I think that those weren't really my children, that someone's made a terrible trick, played a terrible trick on me, and somebody's, someplace in this world, my children are, and that those were somebody else's children. She said, I know that's not true, but sometimes and often I think that. Now, what was the mistake? What was the barrier here? It was that that mortician didn't understand that to begin the grief process, that mother had to have seen the children. Now, if the mortician felt that the faces were too deformed by the accident, then the mortician should have covered the face and let that mother touch the arms, touch the hair, see the little toe that's crooked, see the knee that she had bandaged up the day before. But somehow that mother should have been able to touch and identify those children. Now, as I said, sometimes we sabotage or others sabotage our own grief, our grief processes by doing things that inhibit and stop the grief process. And that's what happened in those two cases. Why am I starting out with hindrances? Because it's important that we know that we can get in the problem of unresolved grief. 10 to 15% of the people that walk through the door of a mental health center that are there because they're depressed, they're angry, they feel guilty, they feel all sorts of things, are there because they're working on an unresolved grief. And if it's a good therapist and asks the right questions, that will come out. And that can be worked on. And that's why I'm still, the next time I'm meeting with my father-in-law, I'm going to try and figure out how I can bring this up and how we can talk about this. Because I feel like maybe he, even after 34 years, and that is not uncommon, by the way, is working on an unresolved grief. So our purpose today is to talk about grief. I work, of course, mostly with people who have experienced a death. But to our grief recovery group, we also have people who have lost jobs, who are people who have gone through a divorce. One person came whose child was incarcerated, and she knew that she was going through a grief process with her child in jail. Loss of a job, loss of health, loss of many, many other griefs. But basically, I'm going to be talking about grief from the perspective of the death of a loved one. But you can use these things with anything. So what are we going to talk about? We're going to talk about all of us have either been through a loss, or we know, unfortunately, we're going to go through one. So we're going to look at how we can help ourselves go through that process, that wilderness experience of grief, or how we can help somebody else go through that process and get through it in a healthy way. Grief is like being in a wilderness. And I usually use a desert, but here in Holden, it's like being in a forest way up in the mountains. The only way to get out of that forest is to go through it. You can't go under it, around it, you can't jump out of it. You've got to go through that forest. And those of you who have been hiking and found yourself way up there in the wilderness know what that's like. You've got to walk that trail out of the wilderness, and that's what the grief work is. And I call it work because going through a grief process, for those of you who have been there, you know what I'm talking about. It's work and it's not easy. In order to tell you sort of our philosophy and get to the point that I'm going to get to today, I sort of have to tell you what I do, so I can tell you from what this philosophy of working on grief comes from. I work in the pastoral care office of a hospital in Davenport, Iowa. There are two chaplains and myself, and I am the coordinator of the grief recovery group, and I function as an assistant chaplain. Now, 11 years ago, one of the chaplains that I work with, who'd been there by then about 10 years, we go up on the floors and we talk to patients and allow them to talk to us and tell us about how they feel about being in the hospital. Maybe they have terminal cancer, maybe they've had a heart attack and they've been this big, strong, 44-year-old athletic person. And who's there to allow them to talk about how they feel about what's happened to them physically and health-wise? Well, this chaplain would go up and he'd hear all sorts of grief stories. not only would they talk about what's happened to them right now, but they would talk about the parent that died, you know, several months ago, or the spouse that died several months ago, or a child that died 7 years ago, or whatever. And 50% of the people that come to our hospital are unchurched. They may say Catholic, Lutheran, whatever, but they don't have a church they go to. So they don't have a minister to go to. Many people feel like going to mental health means you're crazy. And who do they have to go to talk about these things? Well, this chaplain decided we have to have some place for these people to go to learn about grief and to heal. And so we started our grief recovery group. We meet September through June, every other Sunday, from 3 to 5. We get from 30 to 50 people that come every one of these Sundays. There are two of us staff people, and we have about 8 or 9 volunteers, we call them befrienders, that have been trained by our pastoral care office for a year on listening skills and leading small groups. And they have all experienced the loss of a child, husband, parent, and so on. To give you a very quick idea of what we do on this Sunday, the people will come, and this 30 to 50 people, and we will have a teaching presentation where we will talk about some dimension of grief. Maybe we'll talk about anger. Maybe we'll talk about the importance of tears. Maybe we'll talk about the importance of telling the story. Maybe we'll talk about secondary griefs. You know, first of all, you have the death or the loss of the job or whatever, and then you have all these other things that pop up. You know, if you've lost your husband and all of a sudden you find out he had a terrible insurance policy and now you have to get a job and now how do you get your kid through college? And now what do I do? He always did the books. How do I do this? All these things that crop up that make the initial grief even worse and complicated. And the tears come not just from the initial experience of the loss, but all these other things that happen as a result of it. So we'll talk about all these things for about 20, 25 minutes. Then we'll divide up into small groups. Before we came, people were just all sort of lumped together. But as I saw people from having various types of losses, I really felt it was important that those people get with people who were like them. So the survivors of suicide have their own small group. The people who have lost a spouse are in another group. The people who have lost a child are in another group. The people who have lost a parent or brother or sister or friend are in another group. And then, by the grace of the Holy Spirit, and I know it was a gift, one day I put together a group, and I happened to be the leader of that group, and I looked around, and everyone was young, and they had lost their spouse. They were in their 20s, 30s, and early 40s. And that has been the group that is the most persistent in wanting to be healed, to work. They will come time after time. They will open themselves up and allow themselves to work on all those tough issues, probably because they know they got small kids. They got to help their kids get through the grief. They got to help themselves get through the grief. They got to put their lives back together because they've got a whole lot of years ahead of them. And it's been a wonderfully exciting group to watch because they really have been healing. After our small group, which meets for about 40 minutes, then they come back, and they have a report back time. Now, we realize that grief is individual. Everybody's situation is different. But we also realize that grief has its universal aspects. And the exciting thing about this is that the people who are survivors of suicide, and the people who have lost a child, and the people who have lost a spouse, find out that they've all been working on much the same thing. And they realize then that even though their grief is unique, their situation is unique, that they're all in the same boat together. Not only do they discuss in their small group what's been presented, but they can bring up anything. Maybe they're having a terrible time dealing with tears that week, or with loneliness, or feeling like the fifth wheel. They bring whatever they need to talk about up and discuss that. Then the report back time, and then we have, the official meeting is over, we have a milling time. Maybe I really feel akin to you because you have a situation like mine. I can grab a cup of coffee, sit down with you, and we can talk about it together. It gives me as a coordinator time to get together with people individually. Then we have a time, anyone who wants to stay can stay after and have supper together. If you're a widow or a widower, especially, it's awfully tough to go home on a Sunday night, open the door, and have to face sitting at a table by yourself and eating alone. And so that's one time that there's usually about 10 of them that get together, go through the line, and have that meal together. So that's what we do every other Sunday. So the purpose of the meeting is to learn about grief, to be with other people who understand. If your loved one has been gone for a year, maybe some of your relatives still don't want to hear the story. You know, they just want you to be better. And you can come to this group and still share that story, and it's still important to other people. To wrestle with the issues, to persist, and to work. The people who work the hardest heal the fastest. Okay, now I'm going to get to our philosophy of what's important in the healing process. If you have someone important die, or if you have some important loss in your life, job, whatever, health, one of the most important things you can do, or that you can help someone else to do, is to tell the story again and again, and go over it. You know, at a funeral service, what do the people do? They stand by the casket, and as everyone comes by, they are telling the story, how it happened. That's an important part in believing it, in letting it become true and real and sinking in. And as hard as that process is, and as much as we somewhat dislike our funeral industry, there are a lot of good things that come out of that funeral, of that visitation, in being able to believe that it has really happened to you. Okay, now we're going to get to the meat of this, which the other name I was going to give to this class was grief and loss using a biblical model, but I decided it sounded too esoteric or something, and maybe everyone would go, oh, boo, hiss. So, but we're going to get to this anyway, because Jesus, in two instances, shows us fantastic ways to deal with people in grief. The first story I'm going to use, I'll tell you what I'm going to do so you'll kind of know what's going on here. I'm going to tell you these two stories about how Jesus dealt with grief. And we're going to discuss these. See your reactions to these. See if you ever looked at these scriptures from this perspective. Then I'm going to throw it open to you. Some of you who've been through grief are going to say, okay, what's the normal moods, experiences, feelings, and so on that you go through in the grief process? We're going to chart them out. And then we're going to talk about, okay, what do you do to get better? And we're going to talk about some of the things some of you have done to help yourself to heal in whatever grief process that you've been through. And then we'll have some other things we might do if there's time. And I do have a watch here, so I'm watching so that you get a chance to talk too. Okay, the first story. Picture this scene. The disciples and Jesus are walking along, and there is a huge crowd following them. We're talking huge crowd. And Jairus comes along. Now, you may remember that Jairus is the president of the synagogue. I mean, we are talking VIP here, right? Really important person. This person comes up, this Jairus, and kneels before Jesus. And who's the most important people? Who's the most important person in our lives? Our kids, right? Our kids are everything to us. He comes up and he kneels before Jesus and he says, "My daughter is dying, and I know if you come and touch her, she'll be well." Well, you know, we as parents will do anything, anything. We will, you know, fight with tooth and nail to do anything for our children if they're in trouble. So you can imagine how Jairus feels at this point. So Jesus says, "Oh, yes, I'll come with you." And there's this large crowd. So Jairus, the disciples, and the large crowd are moving out. Now here comes the woman with the hemorrhage. She has a hemorrhage, and she's had it for 12 years. 12 years, women. 12 years she's had this hemorrhage. She's gone through a great deal. She's spent lots of money. She's been to many doctors. She's gained no benefit, and she's getting worse. Now, I sort of had this condition for 8 years, and I know how miserable I was, so I can somewhat imagine how miserable she was. But she says, "If I just can touch his clothes, I'm going to be all right." And so she creeps up, and she touches his clothes. I shouldn't talk softly, right? You won't be able to hear me. And all of a sudden, Jesus knows that someone has touched him. And so he turns around in the middle of this crowd and he says, "Who touched my clothes?" And the disciples are going, "Jesus, there's a throng here. You're in the middle of a crowd. Come on, what do you mean? People are jostling at your elbow. What do you mean, who touched your clothes?" And he said, "Who touched me?" And he looked around at the faces of everyone, and then the woman, scared and shaking all over because she knew she was the one to whom this thing had happened, came up and flung herself before him. And do you know the next phrase? Anybody? She told, she what? Close, very close. She tells him the whole 12-year story. Now picture this. Jesus is here, and she's kneeling before. Jairus is standing here going, my daughter is dying. And the disciples are going, Jesus, this is Jairus. He's an important person. You know, we kind of have to get in with the important people. We've been hanging around with sinners and tax collectors. If we could, if you could heal this Jairus' daughter, we'll be in good with the right people. And especially Judas, who kind of thought that Jesus was going to do political things, you know. Really, come on, Jesus. Don't sit there listening to this 12-year story about a hemorrhage. We got to get to the president's house. He might even invite us for dinner. And yet, what does Jesus do? I can just picture, he has eye contact with her, and he listens to the entire story. And then he says to her, your faith has healed you, go, you are well. How many times have we been in the line at the grocery store or caught in the narthex at church, and somebody who has a grief story comes up to us and starts telling us, and we're kind of looking at our watches and going from foot to foot, you know, because gosh, we have to get going. I have to pick up my kid at the piano lesson. You know, you really want them to kind of hurry up with the story because you got places to go and things to do. And this person is telling their story and the whole story. And yet, we don't have the time to allow them to tell that story to us. Okay, second story. Second story is the most perfect story about a grief process. It's the story on the road to Emmaus. Jesus has died. It's the third day. Two people are walking along the road. I hope you've never looked at this story from this perspective before. And then on the same day, we find two of them going along the road to Emmaus, a village about 7 miles from Jerusalem. And as they went, the two of them were in deep conversation about everything that had happened. Jesus had died. The only thing they can think about is sharing the story, their perspective of what happened, how they felt about it, what they would have done differently. They're talking intently. They are so absorbed in their serious talk and discussion, and Jesus approaches them and walks along with them. Jesus comes to the people who are in grief. But something prevented them from recognizing him, and he spoke to them, and he gave the perfect line. What is all this discussion you are having on your walk? He says, tell me your story. And they stopped, their faces drawn in misery. And anyone who's really in grief and freshly in grief, you can see it. It's written on their faces. It's written in their shoulders. It's written everywhere. It's written how they carry themselves. And their faces were drawn with misery, and then said, you must be the only stranger in Jerusalem who hasn't heard about all the things that have happened here recently. They're saying, we're so miserable, we can't believe you're not as miserable as we. I was in a funeral procession not long ago, and as we were going to the cemetery, we passed by people who were eating ice cream cones and skipping along and driving to work and washing their cars and mowing, and I just wanted to scream, why is the world going on as if nothing has happened when this person that I love has died and you don't even care, you're just going on? And that's exactly the way they were thinking. Are you crazy? Aren't you as miserable as we are? Jesus gets back to the topic. What things, he says. He wants them to tell the story. Go on and tell me the story. Oh, about Jesus of Nazareth, there was a man, a prophet, strong in what he did and what he said, in God's eyes as well as the people's. What do we want to do about the person that we love that's gone? We want to tell you the good things about him. We want to tell you the good things. And here the disciples are doing that first of all. But haven't you heard, now comes the anger and the blame. Haven't you heard how our chief priests and rulers handed him over for execution and had him crucified? The anger. We got to blame somebody. It's somebody's fault that this happened. This happens in the hospital all the time. It's the doctor's fault. It's the nurse's fault. The people in the ambulance didn't do it right. They didn't get there fast enough. It's somebody's fault. But we were hoping that he was the one to come and set Israel free. The hopes are gone. The dreams are gone. The person who said to me, my daughter just graduated from high school and she was supposed to go on for college next year. She was going to be a teacher. The dreams are gone. Or the person who says to me, my husband is 55. He was going to retire in 5 years and we were going to travel. The dreams, the expectations, all those things that were supposed to happen didn't happen. Yes, and if that's not bad enough, we're back to anger. If that's not bad enough, some of the women folk, we got to blame somebody again, have disturbed us profoundly. They went to the tomb at dawn, and when they couldn't find his body, they said they had visions of angels who said he was alive. And some of our people went straight off to the tomb and found things just as the woman described, but they didn't see him. So now we got the secondary griefs. Not only did Jesus die on a cross, but now these stupid women folk are telling us stories that he's risen and the tomb is empty, just to make matters worse. So we have our secondary griefs cropping up. Then he said to them, are you failing to understand and slow to believe in all that the prophets have said? Was it not inevitable that Christ should suffer and so find his glory? And he began with Moses and all the prophets, and he explained to them everything in the scriptures that referred to himself. What's he doing? He listened, and now as a counselor to them, he's taking their story and he's reframing it. He's helping them look at the story from a new perspective, from a new angle. Then they were approaching the village and where they were going, and they meant to, and Jesus acted like he was going to go farther, but they stopped him. Do stay with us. He had been a caregiver, and they could tell he had been a caregiver, and they now reached out for more care. Please stay with us. And then it happened that while he was sitting with them, he took the loaf, he gave thanks, he broke it, he passed it to them. Then they recognized him, and their eyes were open. Then they said, weren't our hearts glowing while he was with us on the road? Even before they knew it was Jesus, they were responding to this person because this person had asked them to tell the story. He had stayed with them. He had helped them look at their situation. He cared. And he shared. And then they found new energy and new understanding, and they raced back off to Jerusalem. So many of the right things with these people in their grief process, in these two men. So I want to open it up to you. Do you find either of those scriptures, do you find, looking at it from a new perspective, helpful, disagree? Elmer Witt said the other night, we have freedom here to fail. So I'm opening this up, and if you think that scripture was completely the wrong way to look at it, I'm open to that too. Or could you identify, perhaps, with the people? Does it make sense that the telling of that story and someone there to listen to it and to look at it, does that make some sense? Uh-huh.
The Lynn brothers, are you familiar with them?
The who?
The Lynn brothers.
The Lynn brothers? No, I'm not. Okay, she has said that the Lynn brothers, who are two Catholic priests, have used this story. That's fantastic, and have used it kind of with imaging, and then there's a prayer at the end. Okay, well, that relieves me that somebody famous, because I thought I found this by myself. Gee whiz. All right, great, thank you. Anybody else? Okay. Mm-hmm. Talk nice and loud so the people back here can hear you.
And one of our friends was dying, and we interviewed him, and car, you got somewhere because you got sick. Was the next day, and they were going to sue him and my husband and everything. So we got to know him there. But anyway, after I learned about that, and I was visiting yours at the time, I started using that and just finding out that people's strange unfinished business was, as she said. And it's amazing. I can almost just allow people to express it, that they all had something they wish they had done. Or when somebody died, I was forbidden to go in the homes when my supervisor. But I talked to and I said, sure you, and she talked to visiting nurses, children, that's important, and then they allowed to do that. But I learned from her, and then the just importance of listening and allowing them to tell the story over and over, breath by breath, and so minute by minute.
And so, excuse me.
So you find all these people, once you've learned it, all around you, there are people who want to talk about it. And in church, when somebody is dying, a spouse, I make a point of asking them and listening to the story, because
Dr. Kubler-Ross is, of course, the first kind of pioneer in working with death and dying and getting people to talk and tell their stories. It's amazing. You know, people have been grieving since Cain and Abel murder, and yet it wasn't until 1944 that Erich Lindemann wrote sort of the first modern psychology on grief. It wasn't until the early 50s that there was any significant work on grief, and it wasn't until 1970 that there was actually a medical textbook that came out to help doctors know how to work with people in grief. And that's really fairly sad. I mean, and somebody like Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, who she is referring to, who wanted to talk with patients who were dying, and the nurses would say, oh, there's no one on our floor dying who wants to talk. You know, we hide the patient. We hide the fact from the patient that they're dying, when in fact the patient usually already knows that they're dying and wants to talk about it.
You mentioned sadness and not being able to talk about it, and not even acknowledge it.
Louder. That's a real tragedy. In fact, our society, first of all, knows very little about grief. Second of all, we are death denying, and we want a quick fix. We want everybody to be better fast. I don't know if you're aware, Black Hawk, you know, Chief Black Hawk of the Sauk tribe, he happens to have his village, his summer village is in the Quad Cities where I live. And so I know a little bit about Black Hawk. And when he had, after the Black Hawk War, his son was killed. And Black Hawk, to mourn the death of his son, blackened his face, removed himself from the village, and he was the chief, and separated himself for 2 years. Now, Black Hawk knew more about the grieving process than most of us educated Americans. In fact, there was a survey that was done, and I went to a seminar about a year ago, and this survey went out and asked the average person on the street, how long do you think a normal person should grieve? I almost couldn't believe it, except that there was the survey in front of me, but the average person said, oh, I would say 1 to 6 weeks at the most. Now, I decided that everyone they asked had never lost anyone. Because you may think that's true if you've not had a loss of a loved one, a death. But if you've had a loss and you've experienced a grief, you know that, first of all, it goes up from about 1 to 2 years minimum. And if it's the death of a child, we now say 3 to 5 years. And then the bottom line of all of that is life is never the same. You put your life back together, it's crumbled, and you put it back together, but you never put it back together the same. You always put it back together in a different way. And there's always, you know, that tenderness, that hurt. And most especially with the death of a spouse or a child. Yeah.
I think it's really good.
Can you hear?
Even families, they can talk about
a support type group where they understand. Thank you.
How do you help someone talk when the family that never talks on your area? The family does not talk at all. They have a mother died over a long term, and the sons, half of the sons died or cried at the funeral. The other half just sat there. As adults, they never discuss it among themselves. They never discuss it with the father. The father has never said anything about it.
That's... And they probably are. The unfortunate thing is they have been brought up in that culture where we don't talk about it. We have men here that have been told as little boys that they're not supposed to cry and you're not supposed to express those emotions. We also do that to each other. Children have a tendency to not want to talk to their parents about the death of a loved one. Why? Because when they do, mom cries. And so kids become these unbelievable little martyrs if they don't talk about grandma's death or daddy's death, because when they do, mom cries. So the kid becomes this strong little kid who says, I'm not going to talk about it and I'll keep it inside of me, because when I talk about it, mom cries, and I don't want mom to cry, and I don't want to be the one who makes mom cry. So these things get real involved. And if you've had a Scandinavian history and you have a history of people don't talk, people don't cry, little boys don't cry, Americans want to get over this fast. You know, and everybody wants everybody to get better fast. Why? Because we don't know how to handle it with each other. You know, that's a big question. And I have people that come in to me with that, and I just say, try and get on a one-to-one basis with some of those people at an individual time and see if they'll open up to you on a one-to-one basis, since they won't do it in a family setting. Because you learn the rules in your family. In my family, we did not talk about death, illness, or sex. Scandinavian family, you don't talk about those things. And so when those things happen and you sort of have to talk about them, you kind of, you know, what do I do? This is a taboo subject in my family. So you find somebody else to talk to or you don't talk. And that's a tough situation. And all I can say is see if you can find one person who would be willing to talk and see if they'll bring their feelings out. And better yet, talk about your own feelings. If you're feeling sad because grandma died, talk about how you feel and see if they then in turn will talk about how they feel.
Doris. I think if people live in a town where there's a hospice, they're very fortunate. And I think they should really use that service.
Okay, does everybody hear that? If they live in a town with a hospice, they should use it. Everyone knows what hospice is, where you get home care for the terminally ill. And they often assign, in our hospital, they will assign one of our volunteer befrienders to work with that patient and that family so that they can talk about the illness, talk about the upcoming death, and then they stay with that family for a year afterwards to do follow-up work with the family so that the family is working through that process, or they will stay longer. Good. Gertrude. And it's so important.
And even this summer, the staff is kind of shy. I really miss your husband. He said, maybe I shouldn't have said that.
But you're so glad to hear somebody talk about your husband, right? Because the person who's died, it isn't as if they've disappeared, you know, from our memory. They're still important to those of us, you know, who knew and loved them. And for someone to bring up that topic of your husband and the fact that he brought so much joy to this village is important.
Yeah.
that the memories are still there, and they're good memories. Yeah.
That was helpful in the memorial service we had for my dad several years ago. Other four or five people spoke at the service, and I never really realized how many people he had touched in 34 years at the same church until it was
Then they finally verbalized that. In fact, one of the nicest things you can do to someone when there has been a death is not just to sign your name on the card that you send to them, but either go to them or write on the card something that that person, say it's your mother, did that was very special and that you'll always remember. And those cards are the ones that really touch your heart because you do realize how important that person was. In fact, somebody whose child died, a 7-year-old, called me and said, "The anniversary of the death is coming up. What shall I do?" And I said, "Well," she said, "the friends of my Jennifer want to get together." And she said, "So I want to do something, but I don't want it to be just sad." And so I suggested that they all come, and with the idea ahead of time that they were going to share something that was special, that they remembered about Jennifer being their friend and interacting and so on. And that they make together something and then take it out to the grave. So that she was remembered in a positive and warm and loving way, and then they were able to do something for her, even though she wasn't there in person, but they were still able to do some act of love for her. And they did that, and it was, thank goodness, a success.
Little Jenny Olson died, and they were very active here at Holden, and they established the book corner, Jenny's Corner, which I thought, and that's one way that friends can show that they still remember Jenny.
Right.
A book.
It's that act of caring and reaching out to that family. So often we want people to be well. We don't know what to say. We're somewhat uncomfortable. We don't want them to cry. And yet, maybe sometimes we're doing the exact wrong thing. Very important. I think one of the things that is a myth in our society is that children don't grieve. Little kids as young as 2 grieve. And the unfortunate thing that we do is that we don't deal honestly with those kids. We make the mistake of saying, "We've lost Mom. Oh my gosh, she's lost. Why can't we find her?" Or, "Mother's gone on a long trip. Well, then why isn't Mom coming home? Doesn't she love me? Why did she abandon me? Mother is sleeping. Well, then why doesn't Mother wake up?" We've tried to make death prettier, easier for kids. And what we've done is we've confused them terribly. The most important thing, we have a whole other session on this, is how to deal with kids in a death. And to put it in a very small way, you deal with them honestly. You tell them Mother has died. And you tell them, part of Mother has gone to be with God, but part of Mother's body, we're going to take it to the funeral home, and we're going to have a service, and we're going to put it in the ground, and so on. But you deal with them honestly, and you answer, their questions. And the other thing is, kids so often feel guilty, like it's their fault. I remember one day, our son, who was, it was just a couple years ago, he was probably 8, said to my husband, "I am so angry at you. I don't care if you die, and if you die, I won't go to your funeral." Well, thank goodness my husband didn't die a week after that, because my son would have lived with the guilt, that he had caused his father's death. Or he says, I hate you and I wish you would die, or something dreadful like that. Kid, and sometimes if the other parent doesn't know that, that kid can live with that for the rest of his life and be scarred by that. So, yeah. Oh, yes. Yes. That's why you have to sit down and talk with kids. When grandma dies, when the pet dies, when anybody dies, you sit down and you talk with them and you make sure they understand, even though they've never verbalized like my son did, that it's their fault. Because they will always somehow think, when any of us have somebody that dies, don't we think, I didn't do enough. You know, I didn't do enough. Even if it's a distant friend, for sure if it's a spouse, there's always some guilt. I didn't do enough. I didn't tell him I loved him enough. You know, I didn't get him to the hospital fast enough. Why didn't I notice that she was sick? All of these things. And children feel that too, even though they don't verbalize it. So you have to let them know that it's not their fault ever. You know.
Sometimes death can be a remarkably wonderful teaching experience for a small child. This father was my husband, and grandmother was 3 and a half when she lost both her grandfathers within 6 weeks. And my older son felt that perhaps she was too little to take to the funeral parlor. She would go to the service, but as it worked out, it was necessary for her to be there. And she said she wanted to see her grandpa. So he took her in, he looked, she looked, and she patted him.
Good.
She looked at her father and she said, Grandpa feels like he's made out of clay. And so he said, you're right, Sarah. That's what's there, and the part that you do as grandpa is now going to be with Jesus.
Good, good.
And that was, you know, she cried from time to time, and it was all very real to her.
Mm-hmm. And it's important we let them know that it's okay to cry. They have discovered that there is a chemical in your tears. Some of you who are nurses or doctors perhaps know this, and I see heads nodding. There's a chemical in your tears that when released because of sadness is actually a tranquilizer, and how important it is to get that out and into your system and cry. I say to people when they come to see me, I say, do you feel like there's either an elephant standing on your chest or that your stomach is tied up in knots? And they say, yes, how did you know? And I said, that's grief. I said, have you been trying to hold your grief in and not cry? Oh, yes, I try not to cry. I said, please cry. I said, allow yourself to cry. Go ahead and get it all out, because that's the only way that that's going to be released. If you don't allow the grief to come out in a healthy way, and crying is healthy, then it's going to come out in an unhealthy way. I don't think we're going to have our full 60 minutes here, because I know another class is coming in. And Paul, do you need, you can't use the organ. My husband has a class in here. Oh, okay. Okay, yes, uh-huh.
I think the missing in action parents and spouses have a special burden to bear, which you say helps me to understand and empathize with them in their continued agitation for some kind of action. But most of them still may hold the hope that
yes.
Being held against as well.
Yes. Or being tortured. Did all of you hear that missing in action? When you can't bury that body, it's like the woman whose children, was this really my child that was killed by the motorcycle accident? It's worse. It's far worse, I think, than having someone die. When someone dies, you can bury it, you can work on it, you can go down that path. But when they're missing, or these people who have children missing, this is a terrible thing to say, I hope my children aren't here. I would rather have my child die than my child taken away and be missing and be molested and be on films and God knows what else. I couldn't live with that, I don't think. Because it's, you know, what do you do with that? What do you do with that? You know, that's a worse grief. Okay, any other questions? Mm-hmm. Statements.
What's your reaction and your thoughts towards the grief helpers kit that's been put out by AAL? Or have you seen that?
I have. Is what's AAL?
Aid Association
I haven't seen it. I haven't seen it. I'd be very interested in seeing it, but... So it's not something you just read, but it's something you go through as a group? Is
that's
that?
Right. And you can't hand it out. I've done that with people.
Great.
To read through that.
You know, from what I've said, you know that we don't know much about grief. So I think any program, you know, is definitely helpful, whether it's through a church or whether it's through a hospital or whether individual counseling with ministers. You know, yes, Doreen? Wasn't she right on cue? Thank you, Doris. This is the best little book you can give somebody. He is wonderful. I just heard him a couple months ago. And even though I had read his book, it was great. This is the best little book you can give somebody when they've gone through a death, because it talks about the stages. And to conclude, I guess I'd like to say before I go through these books, the thing that people have said to me the most, and I just read just today that there was a survey done, 40% of the people who are in grief feel that in some point in their grief they're going crazy. They're just going crazy. I'm going crazy. This can't be happening to other people. I'm the only one that experiences the fact that I can't sleep and I can't eat and I talk to my loved one even though he isn't here. And, you know, all I have dreams and I find myself setting the place at the table and all these other things. Or I see this favorite food in the grocery store and then I burst into tears and I run out of the grocery store and I can't go back for a week. What you find when you give somebody this is that all of these things are normal. They're part of the grief process. And we didn't make that chart about going through anger and, you know, and guilt and insomnia and all these other things. But that's what people need to know, is what they're going through is really normal. I have people who come to me only once, because when I finally tell them that everything they're experiencing is normal, they go, oh. And then they know they're not nuts. And then they know they're not going to end up in the mental institution. But what they're doing is going along the path and going through the things they need to go through to get out of the wilderness. How to survive the loss of a love. I'm just going to show you the books they have up in the bookstore. Some of these I haven't read, so I'm just going to tell you that they're there. The loss, death of a loved one, breakup of an affair, separation, divorce, other losses. Widow, this is a young woman who had to put her life back together after her husband died. That looks very good. The bereaved parent. Oh, you know, that's one you really want to hand somebody something so that they can put their lives back together. 85% of the people who lose a child end up in divorce. And if you've got a good marriage, it can make it closer. But if you've got a borderline or bad marriage, it's going to go down the tubes. Helping a child understand death. I think all of us need to understand the grief process so we can get through it. Really important to help that child and not forget that they're looking at things from a different perspective than we are. we use this one in our office. Life is goodbye, life is hello. Lots of good stuff in this one. And then I haven't read this one, but after suicide. When we're talking about trying to put your life back together, and the people I work with most, I think, are families that have whose child has committed suicide. And that, you know, you combine death, suicide, and child, and you've got a volcano that is devastating. The toughest one, I think, of all. This is also a good book. Anything else before we close? I don't want to run over because it's 7 o'clock and my husband's class is in here, and he would be very upset if I took any of his time.
I just want to state that, you know, basically,
oh, we talked about that before you came in. That, in fact, I introduced it by saying that whether it's job, health, divorce, anything, you can lose your wallet and go through grief if you've got 15 credit cards in there. No, okay, I also want to say, anyone who's experiencing some of this and having some difficulty with it, I'm here for 2 weeks, and I'd be glad to meet with any of you individually. Thank you.